From MIT, this is the Energy Initiative. I'm Francesca McCaffrey. On today's show, we talked to Jesse Jenkins and PhD candidate Nestor Staple-Veda of the Electric Power Systems Center at the Energy Initiative. Jesse and Nestor tell us about what the future looks like for reducing CO2 emissions in electricity and talk about the importance of what they call firm low-carbon resources. We also talk about the promising types of energy sources and why current policies might not be supporting the full suite of resources needed to get to a carbon-free grid. Jesse and Nestor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Francesca. Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
So you two have a new paper coming out. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
We have this paper titled The Role of Firm Low-Carbon Electricity Resources in Deep Decarbonization of Power Generation. The paper was co-authored by myself, Jesse here, Dr. Fernando de Cisternes, and Professor Richard Lester.
And the focus of this paper is really on exploring the different combinations of low-carbon energy resources that we need to affordably reach a zero-carbon electricity supply. And so we look at a bunch of different combinations of available resources under a wide range of uncertainties and try to extract some robust insights and findings from that wide-ranging uncertainty analysis.
Why did you decide to write about this topic? What about it is important for people to know?
I was doing a master's in nuclear science and engineering here at MIT and the technology and policy program, something that Jesse and I share in our backgrounds. I had this question, actually, one of my professors, we were talking about how you decarbonize power systems, and we were wondering how you actually determine what will be the most beneficial way of doing it, the way that will maximize social welfare. And so that's how I ended up building on this for my master's thesis. And then at some point after I was done, Jesse and I, we were talking about the findings, and we decided to move this forward, improve the experimental design, take a closer look to the assumptions that I was making before, and then we came up with this topic.
Yeah, what really drew me to Nestor's findings and to the idea of expanding it into a broader paper was that he was exploring the potential role of nuclear power amongst the overall low carbon mix. And this is at a time when we only had 4 nuclear power plants under construction in the United States, and they were facing setback after setback and cost overruns that eventually led to the bankruptcy of Westinghouse, the canceling of 2 of those reactors, and the final 2 are still under limbo and kind of waiting a final decision right now. And at a time when wind and solar were getting increasingly cheap and competitive. And despite that, across the wide range of different tests that Nestor ran, he kept seeing nuclear energy show up in the final mix. And that raised for me a question of, you know, what's going on here? Is this specific technology something that's essential? Or is nuclear an example of a broader class of low carbon energy resources that we might need to get to a zero carbon grid and to complement wind, solar, and batteries like lithium ion batteries? And so we designed a broader experiment and worked on it together to really look at the role of what eventually we dubbed firm low carbon energy resources, which include nuclear power, but is really much broader category. And we find that in this study, it's not just nuclear. Nuclear, in fact, gets substituted out for other firm technologies, but that there's always one or more resources playing the firm low carbon energy role in a zero carbon grid when we look at the sort of least cost mix of resources that we could use to get there. So firm resources, which is really the focus of this paper, are technologies that can supply electricity reliably on demand and sustain that output for weeks or months at a time. And so these are really the sort of reliable backbone of an electricity system. In today's power system, that role is filled primarily by fossil fuels, by coal and natural gas-fired power plants. And in a zero-carbon power system, the challenge is to replace those technologies with other firm resources that can supply that reliability and pair with variable renewable resources like wind and solar, with energy storage, demand-side flexibility, and other resources, but to do so without CO2 emissions. And so that includes technologies like nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, which could enable us to continue using fossil fuels, but capture and permanently store the CO2 emissions, and potentially biomass if we can harvest it at a sustainable scale in a sustainable manner, and also other technologies that are at an earlier stage, like engineered geothermal energy systems, which would be a way to tap into hot rocks deep below the earth and harness that energy to produce steam and electricity across a wider area of the world.
Can you describe the 3 different categories of low-carbon energy technologies you think that we need to focus on specifically?
Yeah, so in our paper, we present a new taxonomy to think about the role of different resources in the electricity system in a low-carbon context especially. And those 3 categories are, first, the firm low-carbon resources that we just talked about, which provide reliability and can reliably meet electricity demand at different types of the year. And then we have fuel-saving variable renewable resources like wind and solar energy, which are variable throughout different timescales from, you know, hours to days to seasons. But when they are available, they're very affordable and can help displace the use of other resources resources that consume fuel at a higher cost. And so we dub them fuel-saving resources because they help back off or reduce the consumption of fuels and other variable costs associated with those other resources in the mix. And then the final category is what we call fast burst resources. And these are technologies like energy storage batteries, demand flexibility, so moving around our consumption in time, or reduction of demand or demand response or curtailment when prices go very high. We might want to consume less in those periods for short periods of time. And all those technologies are very well suited to providing fast or quick bursts of power, but not sustaining them over a long period of time. And so they provide sort of high value flexibility at the times that it's most important and most valuable, but we can't rely on them to sustain that output over long periods of time. That's a role best suited for firm resources.
One of our findings in the paper is that we see that these three different resources, they play a very distinct role in the mix. And one of the, I think, most important findings of the paper is that even if you might be able to fulfill demand and subject to a constraint in emissions, without one of these particular type of resources, the cost and the uncertainty phase in order to get to that point is going to go higher. If you want to think about this, it would be like trying to play soccer with just a goalkeeper and the defenses without the midfielders. What would you do that if you have this particular set of people or participants that are trained, they know how to play their role?
Are all of these technologies supported by current policies, or are there some that need more support due to short-term trade-offs for long-term gains?
Yeah, that's a great question. In the near term, at the moment, what we're primarily supporting are wind and solar energy, so renewable resources, and in some contexts, demand response or flexibility and energy storage. So the fuel-saving resources and the fast-burst resources. So sort of two of the three key parts of the team. But in a lot of contexts, we're not seeing as large-scale support for firm low-carbon resources. And that's largely because each of them face very clear near-term challenges. You know, nuclear power plants have become very large and very complex and difficult to construct, particularly in the West, where we're not so experienced at building large-scale infrastructure projects anymore. And so we've seen cost overruns and delays and bankruptcies that have plagued construction of new power plants and nuclear power plants in that context. As I mentioned, biomass has some sustainability concerns. If we're using land that could otherwise be used to grow food, to grow bioenergy crops, or we're harvesting forests instead of leaving them to absorb CO2, all those have very important conservation and sustainability and even carbon implications that mean we may not be able to harvest biomass at the scale that we would want to if those concerns weren't present. Carbon capture and storage also is at a fairly early stage in terms of scaling up and improving the cost of the technology and is really kind of flatlined in terms of global progress over the last few years. And as I mentioned, enhanced geothermal energy is really at a demonstration stage as well. So these are technologies that look today quite challenging, especially compared to wind, solar, and maybe batteries like lithium ion batteries, which have all fallen in price dramatically in the last few years. So prices for wind, solar PV, and lithium ion batteries have all come down in cost by about 70% to 80%. Just since 2009. So that's, you know, really amazing progress. And these technologies really have the tailwinds behind them and are also therefore receiving a lot of support from policymakers, from corporate procurement and elsewhere. While the other technologies, the firm low carbon resources, appear more challenging and for that reason maybe have not received the kind of public policy support that we might need. And the challenge is that if we don't support them now in the near term, they may not be available at the kind of cost or performance that we'll need in the longer term to get all the way to zero carbon. And that's why we think this research is so important now to try to raise and explain the role of these firm low-carbon resources in getting to a fully decarbonized, affordable electricity supply.
We see today a lot of support, as Jesse was saying, but this support is usually designed to be technology-specific. And many times, people connect supporting one type of technology, sometimes variable renewable technology, solar and wind, they tend to connect that to decarbonizing, and they are not necessarily the same. Actually, one of the different points that we have shown in this paper is that at some point you might be increasing the share of variable renewable, but you might not be reducing emissions as you like to. And that's what basically drives the overcost in achieving a system that is very, very low carbon without having firm resources. So what we need today is a set of policy support measures that go for zero carbon technologies. Because we might analyze some technologies, but we don't know what we don't know. It might be that if you implement something that is actually aiming for zero carbon, some other technology that we haven't even spoken about will come out.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that we focus so extensively on uncertainty analysis in this paper. We model almost 1,000 different combinations of technology assumptions about what their cost or availability and combinations thereof. We model two different regions with very different climate patterns and demand profiles and wind and solar availability. And we model a range of different emissions limits to see what happens as we tighten the CO2 limits towards zero, towards full decarbonization of the power grid. And what we find is that the things that are robust are the sort of role of individual categories of resources, but not individual technologies. And we see, you know, very large ranges of variability in the outputs for, you know, the role, the energy share that nuclear power or wind or solar might play in the final energy mix. But what we do see are a robust role for firm low carbon resources, for some combination of wind and solar as fuel saving resources, and for some combination of energy storage or demand flexibility as fast burst resources. And so we really need to think about, as Nestor said, focusing on ends, not means, and focusing on the class of resources within the power system or the midfielders and defenders and strikers on your team, rather than really focusing solely on means or specific technologies.
What are some of the common misconceptions about firm low carbon energy resources?
Well, I think one of the main misconceptions, which is what we're trying to address largely with this paper, is that firm low carbon resources are optional, that they can be substituted for by a combination of increasingly cheap wind, solar, and batteries. You know, I think those of us who follow the energy or electricity space have probably read a dozen headlines in the last few years about how cheap batteries are the holy grail for variable renewable resources for wind and solar, and that if we can store the energy from wind and solar, then the variability doesn't really matter anymore, and we can rely on these resources to play a dominant role in the electricity mix, and therefore don't need to tackle the challenges associated with, you know, trying to scale up nuclear or geothermal or biomass or carbon capture. And what we show in the paper is that they're really not substitutes, that wind and solar as fuel-saving resources and energy storage as a fast burst resource, they're weak substitutes at best for firm resources. And if we try to make them play roles that they're not well suited for in the energy mix, we try to make our defenders play offense, you can do it technically, we find feasible solutions, but it's much more challenging and much more costly than if we harness firm low carbon resources as well.
I think that one of the most important misconceptions in general about this topic is that, so most people think that storage will solve our problems or that demand flexibility will solve our problems. And they tend to think about that in terms of getting rid of low carbon firm resources. But in reality, what happens is that if I can make the system to operate better, more efficiently with demand flexibility or storage, I can do the same with firm resources. And actually our results show that it's not that you get some value from demand flexibility or storage only when firm resources are not there. You get value out of them when firm resources are there as well. And in some cases, you might get even more value than if you only have solar, wind, and storage. I think one of the most striking findings, for me at least, was we did this case when we interconnected these two systems and we gave the system free connection capacity. And actually, we saw that in the case with firm resources, we also saw a lot of benefit for the system to be connected. But then the extent to which we could increase the connection capacity, then that was providing less value as compared to a case when you only had solar, wind, and storage. And that tells you something. That tells you, like, you get benefits from all these different other resources when you don't have firm, and you get these benefits as well when you do have firm, and in some cases it's even greater.
I think one of the other main misconceptions that is out there is that technologies like wind and solar that are getting incredibly cheap, they have a low what's called levelized cost of energy, which is basically a measure of the average revenue that they would have to earn per kilowatt hour of electricity they produce over their lifetime to pay off all their costs, both the upfront cost and the cost of debt and equity finance to pay for that, plus any, you know, ongoing operation and maintenance costs. And what we show in this paper, again, is because they play different roles, they deliver different value. And so comparing their costs, comparing the cost of wind to solar to nuclear to carbon capture, is a little bit like comparing the cost of a banana and a hamburger when you go to the grocery store and try to decide what you want to buy to eat that night. The cost is important. You want to know that when you're deciding what to buy, but they're not really direct substitutes for one another. So you're not going to say, I'm only buying bananas because bananas are cheaper than burgers. You know, you want to have a balanced diet. You don't want to eat too many burgers. You don't want to only eat bananas. And so again, these costs are important, but they only tell us half the story. They don't tell us about the value that each electricity resource plays in the power system, and they don't tell us about the distinct and complementary roles that they play. And that's where the kind of system modeling that we do, where we look at the whole power system and how it evolves over time, is really important, because you can see that kind of complementarity and interaction between different technologies.
Which parts of this paper would be considered controversial in the energy community? Or are there several parts that are widely agreed upon that you would like to touch on?
Two things. On one side, I would say that the results that we see with demand flexibility, most people tend to think that the resources that benefit the most from having flexible demand are variable renewables. And we actually see that the cases with firm resources, low carbon firm resources, are the cases where the demand flexibility resource is used the most. So basically, we actually see that these firm resources are operated in a more efficient way when demand is more flexible. And so I think that that might be counterintuitive for some people. And then the point that we see these resources, low carbon firm, making a difference in every single case I think it's also kind of controversial, because I do think that some people think that you could get rid of these resources and at some point, at some cost, you will not have a difference. But we don't see that.
Across the literature, I think in the last several years, we've seen some consensus points start to emerge, even just since we, you know, started the various iterations of this paper and worked its way through the peer review process. We've seen several complementary papers come out in recent years as well, which I think are starting to form a consensus that moving to a zero carbon grid with primarily dependent on variable renewables, wind and solar chiefly, is much more challenging than getting to more intermediate emissions reductions with wind and solar. What I think we're showing in our paper and what a number of other recent papers have also demonstrated is that there's sort of an exponentially increasing challenge as you try to push further than 80% wind and solar to get to zero carbon. What I start to see emerge from some folks in the public discussion is this idea that if it gets challenging to move beyond 80% renewables, we should commit now to 80% renewables, push wind and solar to that point, and then that'll buy us 10, 15 years. And when we get there, we can figure out how to solve the remaining 20%. And it's just 20%, we're almost there. And I think that that mentality is a little bit risky. Because first of all, the final 20% may be half the effort because it gets more and more challenging as we go trying to get to, you know, wring the last bits of carbon out of the grid. So thinking of it as just the last 20% is probably a little bit of a misconception. And second, if we don't focus now on the technologies we might need to get to that zero carbon goal and wait until we get to 80% and start running into challenges, they won't be there. They won't be available. They'll still be nascent. They'll still face challenges in terms of public opposition or cost or regulatory environments, and they won't be able to scale at exactly the time that we need them.
Given your findings, what is the biggest opportunity and the biggest challenge for firm low-carbon energy resources?
I would say that the R&D support for low-carbon firm resources and basically policies aiming for CO2 abatement instead of trying to increase the penetration of technologies in a specific way.
Yeah, just as a concrete example of that, I think there's been a lot of discussion in a few states and, you know, sort of on the campaign trail and some primaries about committing to 100% renewable energy right now. And we've had bills that were floated in the legislature in Massachusetts, for example, to legislate that. Hawaii is actually committed to that already, which I think makes a lot of sense given the context of the Hawaiian Islands and their reliance on imported diesel for basically all most of their electricity. And then California last session in 2017 was considering a similar bill that would require 100% renewable energy. And that's an increase from their current target of 50% by 2030. So they're already committed to that. So they're saying, let's just keep going with renewables and we'll just keep upping the target. And what we've seen in the intervening year is something really interesting, which is that right now, California is debating not a 100% renewable energy bill, but 100% zero carbon. And that small shift is really important because, as we mentioned earlier, it's a focus on ends, a zero carbon grid, rather than means, renewable energy. Renewables are very useful tools to get to that goal, but they're not the only tools. And as our paper points out, there are firm resources that are non-renewable that could be very important. And there are also firm resources that are renewable that may not be receiving the same level of policy support that wind and solar have been, or certainly not as currently economically attractive as wind and solar. So that kind of transition from a focus on renewables to a focus on low carbon sends a really important signal that there's an opening, a long-term market opportunity for other resources, including firm low carbon energy technologies, that if they can come to market, there will be some demand for them in the long-term energy system. And if we couple that with near-term research and demonstration support, as Nestor mentioned, to improve those technologies and overcome some of the challenges to scaling them, then I think we have a real opportunity to round out the rest of the low carbon energy team.
If a listener could walk away from this podcast and repeat one thing to the next person they talk to, what would you want it to be?
I think that the main message is that wind and solar and battery storage are making dramatic progress, and that is going to fuel a lot of the decarbonization we see in the power grid over the next decade or so. But to complete the team and get all the way to a zero carbon grid and to do so affordably, we need to round out the rest of the team with firm low carbon energy resources like nuclear, carbon capture, biomass, or geothermal energy as well. And that these are all complementary technologies.
My takeaway from this will be climate change is a very, very complex issue, but it's not the only one. If we could get there with a higher certainty at a cheaper cost or lower cost, then we will have some extra resources to address some other mankind problems. And I think that that is important because sometimes we forget about the big picture. Climate change, again, is very important, very complex issue, but we have so many others. Some people in this world, they don't have healthcare access. They don't have education. They don't have water. And if we can save that dollar to spend it on one of those other problems, I think that that's worth it.
Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Show notes and links for this episode are at energy.mit.edu/podcast. Tweet us at MIT Energy with your questions, comments, and show ideas. And subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts. From the MIT Energy Initiative, I'm Francesca McCaffrey. Thanks for listening.